everyone, and welcome to the last of our Best of 2023 podcasts. And in time-honoured tradition, it's all about film. I'm joined once again by Chris Wald and Wesley Shearer. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hi.
And the way it's going to work is we each pick five-ish films to talk about. I'm rotating between them, and then we'll have a chat at the end about any other business. But Chris, to kick us off, what would be your first choice of the film you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was thinking, looking back over this, that I've actually felt it's kind of slim pickings for a lot of this year. Like, I think this year started really strong and it's finished really strong, but there was a big 6 month stretch in the middle where I felt like I really wasn't seeing a lot of new releases. There just wasn't much that looked that appealing. And yeah, I don't know. We can get any maybe reasons why, like further down the line in the pod. But yeah, for the first one, I'm going to have to go all the way back to the very start of the year. I think it was released literally like the first or second weekend of January this year. And it's, again, it's the problem we have like every year where, you know, critics lists come out and it's all stuff that's going to come out here in January and February. So we can't talk about it until this time next year. I mean, like this year's particularly mad for it because even just like in the coming weeks, you've got like Sofia Coppola's Priscilla and Michael Mann's Ferrari and the adaptation of Poor Things and new Hayao Miyazaki and Alexander Payne and Jonathan Glazer. And, you know, there's just so much stuff coming out within like the next month that we're now going to have to wait another 11, 12 months to talk about. So in a similar vein, first pick for this year is Tar, Todd Field's film, which came out, I think in America it came out in like autumn last year. It was like October, so it really feels like we're really pushing it to be talking about it now. But it came out in UK cinemas in January, which is obviously, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this is aware of what Tar is by now. But centers on a conductor, a famous conductor composer played by Cate Blanchett, and yet another career peak. It just seems redundant almost to talk of Cate Blanchett and career peaks because it seems like she has a career made up of nothing but at this point. And yeah, it's kind of a character study. It folds in some kind of stuff on, you know, abuse of power, some very kind of, it's a very like kind of contemporary like culture study film in terms of like this is a powerful figure who has abused her power and has to deal with the kind of reckoning and fallout from that. But the kind of style of it is really, it's really kind of a big kind of step up for Todd Field as well, who wrote and directed. So he's not a massively prolific guy. He wrote and directed two films previously, In the Bedroom with Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek, which came out in, I think, 2000, and then adapted Tom Perrotta's book Little Children in the mid-2000s with Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson. And that was the last thing he'd done before Tar. He'd kind of been absent for about 15, 16 years. And then just appears with this kind of weird Kubrickian, like chilly, immaculately constructed. It feels on a different level technically from everything that he's done previously. So I don't know if he's been, you know, practicing in his spare time or whatever.
Film school or something at the end.
Yeah, I mean, his previous films were really good, but it was this feels like something on another level. He is also famously, he's an actor turned director, and he, his most famous part is probably he's the pianist in Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick's final film. Nick Nightingale, the guy who's like Tom Cruise's old medical school buddy who ends up inadvertently leading them into the big central orgy set piece, which is my annual festive viewing. Not specifically the orgy set piece, the film as a whole, just Eyes Wide Shut. But but yeah, it's just the way that it handles everything. Again, it feels very precise, but not in a way that feels like overly engineered. There's a kind of organic, you know, you still feel like you're watching actual human beings interact, even though everything is very precisely calibrated for like maximum effect. And it tips over from like initially being, you know, quite a, as I say, a kind of character study, quite down to earth, and it eventually becomes more and more heightened until it almost plays more like horror. You know, in the kind of sequences chronicling her downfall, she's accused, there's a Freudian slip, she is accused of abusing her power, wielding it over particularly like young women under her sway, one of whom, former kind of protege, takes her own life, and the blame is then placed at Lydia Tarr's feet. There are email trails that she tries desperately to delete, and basically everything all kind of comes crashing down around her, and then she has to deal with, you know, the potential damage to her reputation, her career, her relationships, and everything that kind of comes from that. But yeah, as it moves towards that kind of sense of everything coming crashing down, it really tips over in almost ghost story territory. You know, there's never anything that's kind of hacky or explicit as like an actual appearance of a ghost or, you know, slamming doors or, you know, creaky floorboards or anything like this, but it does begin to play about more with those kind of horror tropes. And it's a really interesting way to approach a story like this. It does, it's the kind of thing that could very easily tip over into that kind of reactionary, the, like, here come the woke mob kind of, you know, whatever. But it manages to quite deftly sidestep that, I think, and it's really fascinating. It was a very strong start to the year.
And this was one of your favorites as well, Les.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my number one too. And there's not too much I can add to really what Chris said. Chris summed it up perfectly as always, as Chris always does on this podcast.
Hey, you.
But come on, I mean, what can you say about it? It was at the start, the turn of the year, as Chris said. One of my really, really good friends, shout out Spencer, if you're watching and listening in the near future, had been talking about this for a while. She lives in New York, so she got to see it a
Right.
long time before we did, as Chris alluded to at the start of this. And she was like, "You have to see this. You're going to love it. You're going to love it." And I didn't really know a lot about Todd Field. I knew who he was, I knew what he directed, but I hadn't seen any of his stuff because he hasn't really made that much, as Chris also said. So I wasn't knowing, I went into this not, you know, knowing what to expect other than Cate Blanchett being amazing as she always is. And she really is so good in this. I mean, performance of the century, it's unreal what she does in this film. It lives or dies on the central performance. It really does. And that's not to take away from, you know, what the direction is and the writing and everything else that goes on and all of the supporting cast, but it really does, you know, hinge on what Cate Blanchett does in this film. And she does it so well. And it really is a, the trailers are, and also the start of the film is very, very jargon heavy.
Right.
And like, especially in its opening scenes. And I think that can really seem like it's a barrier to the film, but actually the dialogue itself is just really incidental. Like, it's not about what is said specifically, but sort of why and how it's said. Like, I was speaking to a friend about this at the start of the year, and I remember saying that I feel like you could set this in an entirely different world, in an entirely different profession, in an entirely different language, and you could watch this without any subtitles and still understand the film completely through all the rhythms and the beats that happen and take place, which is just, it's just honestly, it's elemental. I saw it twice this year, not since February. I've not rewatched it since then, actually, but it still is like playing over and over in my mind, and especially the part that Chris mentioned as well. Very astutely, like how it really is. That was in my notes too, about how it's basically a psychological ghost story, in so many parts. And yes, there isn't any jump scares, as Chris said, but apparently I've seen it twice now and I've not noticed this. I don't know if you have, Chris, but apparently there's actual scenes where you can see sort of ghostly figures in the background that has been like ingrained within the film. And I've still not even managed to pick them out, but it's almost like the sort of ghost of Lydia Tarr's past, or her rewritten past as she has rewritten it, is sort of starting to catch up with her present at the expense of all of the future elements of her profession and her personal life. And yeah, and the sort of commentary on it has been a little bit insufferable at times, because it's quite polarizing. But it's interesting that I think it's at a time where ambiguity in art is somehow turned and twisted to be seen as political. So if you don't take a stance on something immediately, then that is seen as a political choice. And actually, I think what the beauty of this film is that its detractors are on the complete ends of different spectrums and why they don't like this film and why they think it doesn't work. And I think there's just so much, so many layers to unpack in the middle of all of that. And it definitely doesn't have a definitive statement on Lydia Tarr itself, although I believe it does based on my viewings of it. But you can view it in whatever way you choose to. And I think whatever way you choose to, you get different readings from it. And I got different readings from it on both viewings. And it still holds up. And it's just, yeah, my film of the year, absolutely.
Two things to come from that. I was going to ask, but you have already answered, Wesley. You've seen it twice, because I was going to say, sounds like a film to be admired greatly, but perhaps not enjoy, is enjoyed the right word, or is there enough going on in terms of filmmaking to enjoy?
Yeah, I think, yeah, so when I first saw it, I saw it with a friend of mine, and Mike and I went to see this film, and both of us were quite taken aback by the ending, which I will not spoil whatsoever, but we were both a bit unsure of it. And as we walked back, you know, the 15-minute walk from the cinema that we saw it in, we both came to different conclusions on it, and I came to a better conclusion than what he did at that moment. And I've not actually spoken to him since then to see if that's changed, but it did change for me on the second view, and it actually cemented further what I was kind of gearing towards. And then when I went and saw it the second time, I took my my partner with me, and she was absolutely, and had saw the trailer for this, and just like, I have no interest in this whatsoever. It seems really pretentious, really like classical music heavy, really cumbersome, and just, yeah, not what I'm into. And I was like, same, to be quite honest, but trust me, I think you'll get a lot from it. You really will. She loved it. She absolutely loved it for all the different reasons than my friend liked it. So there must be something in it there for so many different people to just really take from it. And as I said, if you can get past the barrier of how jargon heavy it is and just realize that none of what they're saying really matters, if that makes sense. Like, I know that sounds really bizarre,
but totally
the actual content, I mean, there's literally 5-minute long conversations about classical music. I have no idea what they're talking about. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because what they're talking about doesn't matter, but how they're saying it and how that impacts all the characters in the film is really what makes sense. So you could really set it in a film production company or some sort of corporate environment, like, and the message would land. Yeah, it's great.
It is very entertaining as well. Like, it is very funny as well all the way through. Like, it's very like darkly funny, but like, yeah, Blanchett really goes for it, and it never tips over into like camp or anything, but she's definitely like kind of skirting around the edges of it in places, just in how big she's able to go, you know. It's
all I'll say is apartment for sale. If you've seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about. That is one of the funniest parts of the whole film, and it does have that humor throughout it, as you said.
And the other thing I've realised is I got my Todds mixed up, because that's not the Todd. Who's the Todd I'm thinking of who's done films with Cate Blanchett?
Todd Haynes.
Well, funny you should say that, because our joint second pick.
Well, let's seamlessly move into that and go, Westy, what would you like to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. Did I might have even said Todd Haynes during that, did I? I can't remember.
No, you didn't.
That's good. But Todd Haynes, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if I did say that, because Todd Haynes is always on my mind, because Todd Haynes has done it again with May December, which I believe is also one of Chrissy's picks this year. I saw it so recently, and I've only seen it once, that it hasn't really superseded Tar in terms of my top films of the year yet. But that's not to say it can't on a rewatch, because it just feels like custom made for me, this film, as does all of his films. Like, I think I've spoken on the podcast before about how I can make a case for Todd Haynes to be on like my Mount Rushmore of filmmakers. I've definitely mentioned before. I know Chris has as well. And I can never really quite put my finger on what it is about his filmmaking that really connects with me so deeply. I think his films tend to be like everything that I want from cinema. So they're really pristine, yet they're really dark under the surface of everything. They're really challenging, and they're sort of character-driven as well, and it's character over plot, which I love too. They're really subtle, but subtle and ambiguous. They're also really atmospheric, but the thing most of all is that they're really deliciously camp, and I think that's also why I love Pedro Almodovar's work as well. And I think this is probably, I mean, Todd Haynes is his filmmaker in his own right, but I think this is Todd at his most Pedro. And it landed so well for me. So I don't even really know how to describe the film, other than, so the premise of the film really is about an actress played by Natalie Portman who comes to visit Julianne Moore, who is, how do I put it? She had a relationship with a very young minor when she was an adult. At one point, and this is not a spoiler because this is the premise of the film and it's at the very start of the film, and they are together as a couple as he has grown into, you know, mature adulthood, or what you seem to be as mature adulthood. And Natalie Portman's character comes to visit her because she's going to play her in a sort of TV movie, if you like, and wants to get to understand and know who she is and everything about her and her family and her familial life and her personal life. So that's the premise of it. Apparently, it is based very, very loosely. It's not written by Todd Haynes. It's a new screenwriter, I think. I think this might be one of the first pieces of work that's been adapted, but it was very loosely based on some story that was quite well known in America, maybe in the 90s, potentially. Anyway, so I think the film itself just works on all those levels, as I said, that Todd Haynes films usually work for me. Like, Carol is one of my favourite films of recent memory. I still love it. I still think about Safe regularly as well. It's just some amazing performances. Loads with Julianne Moore, and obviously, as you said, Ali, Cate Blanchett throughout his filmography. But the performances in this are some of the most remarkable on-screen performances that I've ever seen from a cast in years and years and years. Charles Melton, who plays Julianne Moore's husband in particular, who is an absolute revelation in this, he's honestly incredible. Reading up on a lot of what Todd Haynes was talking about in terms of the film and the making of the film, he's quoted one of his friends quite a few times now in interviews, where he said that the reaction that his friend gave to Charles Melton's audition tape or one of the cuts of the films was that, and I'm just going to read it from somewhere so I can remember it, Charles moves like a child and an old man, a perfect combination of the two. And I think it really sums up how perfect he approaches this film as a filmmaker, but also as Charles Melton approaches it as an actor. I wasn't particularly familiar with him. I think he was quite well known in the Netflix TV show Riverdale, which I only watched like the first season of and didn't really watch much more than that. But this is his first kind of foray into sort of art house cinema, if you like, I think. And he's incredible in it. He's basically this, you know, this character who's been trapped in this relationship for so long and hasn't really found out who he is yet, and feels like he's got this sort of happy familial life, but hasn't really like looked inward and addressed who he is, because he have kids, he's got a wife, and he doesn't really know how this has impacted his life personally. So it really deals with that sort of power struggle really, really well. And what I love most about the film is like, when you watch it, you question, whose eyes are we viewing this film through? And it's really sort of, it's difficult to really tell, I think. Like, the whole film is basically like one big hall of mirrors. You just never really know who you're looking at. You never really know what you're seeing, if that is actually what is in front of you. And it's summed up perfectly in one of the best scenes, I think, which is when they go to take Julianne Moore's daughter to buy a graduation dress. And it's so deeply unsettling. So it's basically shot from behind a mirror. Mm-hmm. So you see Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman's looking at towards the camera, but you also see these mirrors around them at the side of them as well. So it really forces our focus and our perspective to completely shift and change throughout the shot, even though the shot itself is entirely static and it doesn't move whatsoever. So you're basically watching one actor, but the other is also trying to catch a glimpse of them. So you've got this game of cat and mouse through like the subtlest body language, and it really hammers home that element of every character is basically playing a version of themselves throughout this film. So everyone is sort of seeking their own truths or trying to find out what their truths are by distorting the reality that's happening around them. So it's just, it's honestly amazing. And the music is incredible as well. I think Todd Haynes chose to use a reorchestration of the score from a film called The Go-Between, which I've not seen, but I believe is a 1971 film. I think Harold Pinter wrote the screenplay, but it's also about a quote-unquote forbidden romance. Yeah. And it works so effectively to drive home that sort of subtle element of camp, which is very tricky to do when you're dealing with really, really tricky subject matter like this. But there's another layer in it, because obviously Natalie Portman's character is trying to get to the bottom of who Julianne Moore's character is, and she's making a TV movie, so it's also got that Hall and Mirrors thing again, where it turns it back onto us as to how do we consume these types of stories through the media, whether that's glossy magazines, whether that's through TV dramas and melodramas and stuff like this. Honestly, Ali, it's just, it is amazing. Like, I could not stop thinking about it for weeks after I saw it. And I was waiting for it to come to streaming to watch it again. I've just not got around to it. So I'm looking forward to
it. I think it is on streaming now.
It is on streaming now. So it was on Netflix, I think at the start of December in America, but it's not on Netflix in the UK. It is on Sky, I think, have the exclusive rights to it. So you can get it through Sky or through Now TV. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm excited to hear what Chris thinks about it, because I know he likes it, but yeah. You can talk about it for days, which is what is so good about it.
Yeah, I loved it too. Like maybe it pushed my favorite of the year. I think it's great. I mean, I'm a big Todd Haynes fan as well. Like I've talked about him, I think, every time he's put out a film, as long as we've been doing these podcasts. Like this last one was the Velvet Underground we talked about a couple of years ago, and then before that, Dark Waters. But I think what he's really good at is like consistently throughout his career is being able to kind of keep an analytical distance. So you're always aware you're watching something that's constructed, and you're always allowed to think about what it is he's shown you critically, but also somehow is able to construct that around really involving melodrama that can play straight. Like if you did just want to look at this as like a domestic drama, you could do that, but he's also constantly kind of prodding you to think about what it means in the kind of wider media context and media landscape. And he's really good at actually involving kind of real people's stories in a way that doesn't feel exploitative. Like I think one thing that's really striking about, you look at so many films he's made throughout his career that are based on real people, whether it's I'm Not There about Dylan, or Velvet Goldmine about like Iggy Pop and Bowie, that it's always kind of fictionalized versions of the characters. He's never actually taken the real person, which means that he can draw on the kind of the things that you associate with them without ever actually smearing the people involved, or it can play about with like the idea of them and what they represent without ever actually like feeling too intrusive into their own personal lives. And that's kind of been a recurring theme for him as well, is this kind of unknowability of real people, whether it's in having like six different people play Bob Dylan and I'm Not There, or like recasting like different elements of Iggy and Bowie and Velvet Goldmine, or even like back to before he started making features, where he made his Karen Carpenter biopic with Barbies. He's really good at basically conveying the unknowability of like people who you maybe have this parasocial relationship with that you feel like you know really well. And in this case, it is like, as Wes was saying, is based on a true case. The woman's name is Mary Kay Letourneau. She it was a kind of big scandal, tabloid scandal, for obvious reasons, in America in the 90s. But the fact that Julianne Moore, her performance, if you look at archive news footage, she's clearly modeling her performance on Mary Kay Letourneau, but she isn't playing her. It's a different woman. It's her own kind of self-contained character. So again, it avoids that kind of icky tabloid, like you're looking at something that feels a bit gross, or it's a really tricky balancing act to pull off.
Takes
And he
away the
just
idea of the voyeuristic aspect to just be, you're not looking at this for anything sensational, but you're being forced to kind of,
yeah,
take your
but
own
then.
take on it.
But then at the same time, you are being confronted with that voyeuristic aspect, because now it's like you take away the fact that it isn't the real person that you're looking at. You're then left with the question, well, why do I want to see this?
Yeah, but is
I'm
that not
sure.
because it's a great film, well acted?
Absolutely. But then
I guess
just
I'm trying to get
because
to
of
the
the.
idea is if the real people aspect of it is vital to the film, because I had never heard of the thing, I don't know if you guys had beforehand. Would that make a difference?
I hadn't heard of it beforehand, to be fair. I didn't know anything about it beforehand whatsoever. And did you, Chris?
I'd heard of it, but again, I think like you could come at this with a very prurient interest. Just because it's so unusual to have that kind of like to have a woman seen as the predator in a relationship like that, rather than the other way around. Again, not dissimilar from Tar. To have that kind of abusive power and that kind of power dynamic in a relationship. And there is the potential there for it to become like a really exploitative film, as we see with Natalie Portman in the film itself. Like it's so hard to end up telling this story in a way that doesn't just feel like the front page of the National Enquirer or something like that. Just these like in the most scandalous tones. But again, he finds this perfect tone for it that is able to encompass like dark humor and melodrama, but also as I say, it's just always keeping you at that kind of analytical distance to really think about what it is you're seeing and why, what is driving everyone involved, whether that's characters, director, audience. Yeah, it's great. It's like a magic trick. It's unbelievable.
Well, if you guys talk about the rest of your films as long as those, I'm going to save this. We're going to be here till midnight. So as usual with my choices, I've tried to keep them all Scottish. Well, I have done. A lot of them, a few of them I've seen at the Glasgow Film Festival again, and that's one of my first ones, or my first one rather. And it's a documentary. It's called Cassius X: Becoming Ali. and it's based on Stuart Cosgrove's Cassius X book, which, like the film, it looks at that period in Muhammad Ali's life where he goes from being the young fighter Cassius Clay, he discovers Islam, and he starts to call himself Cassius X. And then, of course, the next step is Muhammad Ali when he becomes... So it's a story I didn't really know that well. I knew a little bit about Ali as a boxer. I knew he was fighting people like the big London guy, Henry Cooper. And also, you know, there was kind of lots of fights over a short period of time. But in the background to all that, he had kind of renounced Christianity, which had been brought up, had moved towards Islam, became really good friends with Malcolm X. They were really close, like brothers, big brother, young brother with Malcolm X, the kind of big brother. And then there was kind of fallouts from that. And then he moved, partly because he moved towards the Nation of Islam as a movement. And of course, behind that, you've got all sorts of racism and other cultural movements going on. It's really not about Ali at all. It's about cultural and social time in America. And you know, and what a kind of boiling pot that was. And here was this hugely charismatic character who would go on to be the greatest, or at least the best known sportsman in the world, who was almost pushing against what conventional white America were saying and wanting him to be, and doing it right for him. And so how it works is, this was filmed during COVID, and the director, who's a guy called Muta Ali, who I had on the podcast, the Scots Way podcast, spoke to him when he was in America. And he uses the fact that this was filmed during COVID and he turns it into a positive. So you get these really intimate interviews with a lot of people who were there, and they're one-to-one in a room. And for some of them, it's the first time they've spoken to someone in a room for some time. So, you know, they really are kind of special chats. And then there's a lot of footage. There's not a lot of live footage, so they use a lot of stills, a lot of black and whites, but he puts them together almost as if they become moving, almost like animation. So you see certain fights with Sonny Liston and things like that. And it really kind of, it makes an impact that I think just watching, like the Rumble in the Jungle, where you see everything unfold, that's big technical. This is much more small and intimate, and just telling a really interesting story about a hugely famous man in a way I'd never seen before. And you also, through some of these interviews, you get the sense of how his move to Islam changed his life completely, but also changed the life of those around him completely. His family. At the time, there was a girl who basically gave him back the engagement ring, you know, because his family went, well, you can no longer have anything to do with him because of that change. And she's still alive now, or at least she was when they made the film. And still, you can see the heartbreak. I mean, it's utterly heartbreaking to see she's gone on. She was a successful singer. She's a family of her own. But in that time where she almost, you know, became the other half of Cassius Clay, as it would have been at that time, it still clearly, you know, has pangs of hurt and everything on it. I wasn't sure what to expect. I'd read the book. I really enjoyed the book. I think Stuart Cosgrove's a really good writer. But they've taken what's a really deeply researched book and got the story out of it, the kind of essence of the story out of it, which was a very kind of human thing that was going on, to the backdrop of, as Stuart Cosgrove's done in his other books on soul music, where really it's about what was happening in America at the time. He's done that again with this. He's looked into the whole circus around Ali, or Cassius and then Ali, but the people that were surrounded. And he talked to a lot of journalists as well, and a lot of journalists who were really on his side really took against him, and then they came back towards him when they... He seemed to stay true, in a sense, to himself while America was changing all around him. And America went away from him and then eventually came back to him. Well, he still, I think, stayed true through that whole thing, which says a lot about the man himself. It's a really interesting documentary. And I think it's only recently been in cinemas. It was at the film festival at the start of the year. It's recently been in cinemas, but I'm guessing you'd be able to track it down and stream it if you wanted to do such a thing.
Sounds great. Yeah. What did you say it was called again, Ali?
It's called Cassius X, Becoming Ali. Yep. And the book's good as well. Chris, your second choice.
I've kind of, right, to preface this, kind of found, like, over the last few years, like basically since lockdown, like basically as my film consumption has increased even beyond what it was pre-lockdown, The one thing that slipped down my priority list when I'm looking at a film now is plot. Like, I don't really care at this point. It's very far down. Like, when people talk about like plot holes and like, you know, unresolved stuff, I'm like, I don't care at this point. I mean, I think I'm kind of come to the point where I'm like, you know, there's really only so many basic stories you can tell. And there are however many hundreds and thousands of films and books and whatever, any other medium that you want to tell a story in. So it's more about, like, you know, obviously how you tell that. It's the storyteller rather than the story, right? It's whether it's character details or it's like how it's shot, or whether it's, you know, just whatever it is that comes together in what I'll loosely term vibes. And that's, I think I'm becoming like a vibes first kind of guy where that's really like what I'm looking for.
I'm with you here, Chris. I'm with
you. Are the vibes good, or are the vibes right for the film? And kind of emblematic of that this year was Past Fiction, which is a French film. It's by Albert Serra, who is a Catalan filmmaker and is renowned for making kind of largely historical films, but, you know, largely abstracted from like narrative. They're quite like immersive and quite he made The Death of Louis XIV with Jean-Pierre Léaud a few years ago, made like Liberté a few years ago, and for Past Fiction, it's set in what appears to be the present day in Tahiti, and it follows a French ambassador played by Benoît Magimel, who is probably still best known as the young star, the piano teacher, the Michael Haneke film opposite Isabelle Hooper. He'd have been
I remember it well.
At the time, he's now in his 40s. And it probably gestures more towards narrative than a lot of Albert Serra's previous work is, but it is not a film to come if you're looking for like narrative resolution or any kind of clear-cut story. It's basically following him in his role as ambassador, just kind of hanging out for close to 3 hours. But then as the film goes on, there are kind of intimations that the vibes are getting bad. It goes from like a good vibes film to a bad vibes film. There's kind of intimations that the French are maybe about to resume nuclear testing in the waters around the Polynesian islands. There's, you know, again, like implications that he's kind of in over his head in some matters there, and there's still stuff that he can't control. But the style of it is really, really incredible. So the way it was shot, I think Albert Serra, if I remember it, like, had three cameras rolling at all times, like just at all times, didn't cut, and ended up with about 180 hours of footage, and would just sit in the edit booth with all three cameras rolling simultaneously and just like pull out stuff that looked good. He was like, yeah, I like this, I like that, I don't like this so much, and kind of found the shape of the film from that. So I say it's a luxuriant runtime, like it's close to 3 hours. But I mean, when you consider that it could have been literally 60 times that length, you know, you're kind of getting off lightly. And what it's ended up with is kind of, it reminded me quite a lot of like the kind of, I guess, Shore Leave bits, you could call them, from Beau Travail, like the Claire Denis film, which is set in the French Foreign Legion. So again, also dealing with kind of France's colonial presence overseas. And a lot of that is set out in the desert, but then, you know, the soldiers occasionally get like time off to go into town, and they hang about in these kind of like quite, you know, low rent looking nightclubs. And, you know, they obviously have the privilege of being like white soldiers in a kind of a largely not white setting, and everything that comes with that, all the kind of implications. And it really reminded me of those sequences, just in that kind of mixture of like seediness and that kind of like old world glamour as well. You know, it's the kind of thing you'd see from like looking at National Geographic in the 80s or whatever. But it's shot in a way that's also kind of really reminiscent of like kind of digital era Michael Mann. Like, it really reminded me of Miami Vice a lot of times, like the film rather than the TV show. And what he did with that and Black Hat. So yeah, it's just, it's a really, like, it will not be for everyone. I want to preface it with that. But I think if you can give your time and attention to it and just let the kind of mood overtake you, it's got a tone kind of unlike anything else I can really remember. It's like, I mean, I was lucky enough to see it in a cinema, which I think would make a difference. I'm really not sure how it would translate to home viewing, especially where, you know, you'll have many other things vying for your attention. Yeah. But if you can settle in it and just let it wash over you, it's an experience that's there's not been much else in recent years to compare it, I would say.
He hasn't promised a 9-hour director's cut, has he?
I mean, not yet, but a guy can dream.
Exactly.
What's your second choice?
Second choice, well, technically third choice now, isn't it?
Well,
really?
Yeah, third choice, yeah. I guess. Yeah.
Let's go with okay, so yeah, definitely. Just trying to keep it in my head there, going, is that definitely my third choice? Yeah, it will be. Past Lives, which was such a surprise to me this year. I'm not sure what the market was like back home in Glasgow, but down here it was everywhere. You couldn't move from seeing the poster, and it just sort of like lured us into wanting to go and see it, but not thinking too much of it. And the marketing is quite interesting for Past Lives, in that I think it would generally have you believe that it's this sort of hipster rom-com, or maybe not hipster rom-com, but maybe just like a long-lost love story, and that's really all it's about. But actually, I think it's so much weightier than just a simple romantic story. So the premise of it is basically they are two friends, two childhood friends over the course of probably about a quarter of a century, maybe, who have a friendship relationship when they're children, back home in their home country. And then one of them moves to America and, you know, leaves that relationship in the past and forgets all about it, really, to a degree, sort of decompartmentalizes it, if you like. And as they grow apart and their lives change and they lead different lives, their lives start to interconnect again through different ways. And I believe that the plot itself was partly, at least a little bit, semi-autobiographical, and was inspired by some of the events that happened in the director's life. The director is Celine Song, who this is her debut film, I think, as far as I'm aware. And it is beautiful. It really, really is. It's just a remarkable little film. I love it so much. And I think I really, really love films that are really confident and comfortable in their own silence, basically. So I think this is the perfect example of that. Genuinely, there are so many elements or so many scenes in this film where there is just silence for, you know, what could feel like an uncomfortable amount of time, but actually is, to me, feels quite comfortable. And I just love the confidence of that, especially from a debut filmmaker to leave so much silence in our film. I think it's amazing. It's really, really impressive. That's not entirely unsurprising either, because I think Celine Song's background was or is theatre. Right. So she is very much aware of, you know, how to create a sort of atmosphere and an emotion and get your point across without always having to fill space with dialogue, I think. So that is really interesting. But yeah, it's a great little film. I don't want to spoil it too much in terms of plot. Hopefully that, as I said, the kind of coming together of two lives from different nationalities leading into different places, coming back together again, gives you the idea of what it is. But it's the questions that it asks us that I find it's really interesting. It's nothing, you know, remotely deeply out there that's never been asked before on cinema or not on a cinema screen, but it's enough to just really make it stay with me. I think it really asks us to look inwards. It really asks to look at all the paths that we've taken in our lives and all the paths that we've left behind naturally as well, just by making that choice, and how those all intersect with each other and how they inevitably shape us, whether that's consciously or subconsciously, and how these seemingly insignificant things that can unlock memories and give meanings to things that just become so much more deeper and so much more profound than you would ever have anticipated in those moments. It's great. The pacing of it is immaculate. It is really, really short. Some people have said that towards the end it gets a little bit rushed, but actually I think it really builds tension quite nicely. And there's a scene towards the end, which, I mean, is basically the final scene, but isn't quite, which is literally my favourite scene of the year by a country mile. And it just left me really, like, quietly, sort of subtly sobbing away in my seat. It's just, it's beautiful. I think without doing it, well, not a disservice, because I love this film, but comparing a sort of Western film to a slightly non-Western film, but I feel like it's a really lovely sort of quiet and adult companion to The Worst Person in the World, which obviously I raved about on previous podcasts. But it adds in this sort of layers of the immigrant experience to it as well. And it's beautiful. It's called Past Lives. I believe it's streaming maybe on Sky as well, actually. And yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful film.
Fantastic. Before we move on, I just want to clarify, are you guys happy that you've talked about three films each? Brilliant. Okay. Well, yes. I'll quickly do, because I've only done one, I'll quickly do two, kind of put them together because they were both made on really small budgets. And it's really the fact they were made at all that I'm interested in. So the first one is Dog Days. It's on iPlayer. It's still on iPlayer. It was kind of split into six parts. I saw this at the Glasgow Film Festival as well, as a whole. I think it was only an hour long, but it was put as a whole. And it's set in Dundee. It's about James. Have we spoken about James Price previously?
Yeah, we did. I brought up Boys Night a few years ago, which was a short. And yeah, I've also seen Dog Days. Like, I'm a fan. So yeah, I sought it out when it came out on iPlayer.
Yeah. Well, if I just, and also I should mention that the music for it's done by Scott Twynham, who I speak to on the podcast about it and who I really love as a musician. I think he makes amazing music. So it's a kind of simple premise. You've got a guy who's living on the street called Zoso, which I'm sure that was Jimmy Page's sign in Led Zeppelin. You know, they all each had like kind of wee signs, I'm sure. So that's by the way. But anyway, he's on the street and he's wanting to maintain a relationship with his estranged daughter who is living with her mum and the new partner. Things are not going well. He gets a guitar gifted to him. I think that's right. Does he steal the guitar, Chris? It's a while since I've watched it.
Yeah, I think there's, I haven't watched it since the summer either, but yeah, I think the guitar is possibly stolen, or at least it's implied that it's stolen. Yeah,
he gets it. Maybe he manages to keep it. I think
he acquires a guitar, let's just say.
Yeah, he gets a guitar from fair means of foul. And he's got musical talent, and that kind of talent offers him hope in the pretty desperate situations, but it also takes him into places where he doesn't feel comfortable. So a lot of it's about belonging, about the difficulty in kind of shifting in somewhere where there's a kind of structure, not just of class, but of wealth as well. So he has all of those things. It doesn't pull its punches, you know, it really kind of shows things as they are. But I really enjoyed it. I thought a bit like his short films, he really kind of captures real life for some people that it's not often seen in cinemas, definitely, and not even on the telly. I don't know if you agreed with any of that, Chris, since you've seen
it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think he's got a great ear for dialogue and a great sense of location as well. I mean, when was the last time you saw Dundee put front and center the way it is here, you know, and like really captured in a way that feels like recognizable to anyone who's ever visited the city? I think like just the performances are great as well. I mean, Conor McCarron is like, I mean, unrecognizable is that he was the star of
it. That was the light. It took me a while to work out that it was.
Because obviously he'd have been a teenager still when he did that, or at least in his very early 20s at a push. But yeah, completely unrecognizable now. He's fully like grown up. And yeah, just a cracking performance. Again, like I think like that's another one of like James Price's strengths, is like being able to get that kind of level of naturalistic performance. Is something that really bugs me a lot of the time about Scottish film, is how often it's kind of felt like, oh, we need to make ourselves intelligible for an international audience. And so there's the kind of overly enunciated, like, oh, well, that's a wee shame, you know, kind of thing, whatever, where it's really like, nobody actually sounds like that.
The only people that sound like that are people that you used to, when you were at school and the teacher would make you read out a passage from a book.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it sounds like. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the people and the characters in his films, like, just sound like actual people that you would meet, you know. They sound like people you know. And yeah, he's got a great eye, he's got a great ear, and yeah, I'm excited to see him like continue to Absolutely. Get bigger budgets, hopefully.
I really want to watch this because I really enjoyed the short, so that sounds great.
I think the cut that you saw, Ali, is now also up on iPlayer. Like, it is up in the individual parts, but the 1 hour cut also went up within the last month. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but
I would suggest that's the way to watch it, Wesley, if you do. And you're spot on. It's like that scene in Gregory's Girl where he has to read Shakespeare in the class, and that's exactly how he's doing it, in a kind of unnatural way while the guy's getting his windows done.
Yeah,
and you're right about Dundee as well, Chris. I watched this and then I read Don Patterson's memoir Toy Fights, which is all about the poet and aphorist Don Patterson's Young Life, and it's all set in Dundee, and they could be partner pieces, and it's great to see Dundee getting represented, and you know, warts and all, in that way, which has kind of not happened so often, I think.
Yeah, and certainly not one Succession film there.
Well, yeah, that's right, exactly. But you can see it's a place that maybe your man from Succession came from. The other one is The Difference Between Us. And I'm guessing that this was made on a budget even lower than Dog Days. It's a film by a filmmaker called Etienne Kubwabo. Now, we've had Etienne on the podcast a couple of times. The first time because he brought out the first comic book with a Scottish comic book with a black superhero in it called Beats of War. I think there's four of them now. And back then he was like, I'm going to do this. Spoke to him. This is the comic book version, but I'm going to get two films. And his ambition was charming. You know, it wasn't blowhard. This is what he wanted to do. And here he is a couple of years later, and he's made a feature film. And that's astonishing, you know? And not only that, it's been shown at the CCA. It's been at Summer Hall. It's been around Europe. I'm not going to kid you. You can see that it's been done on a budget. Absolutely, that, you know, things were done on quickly and on the hoof, and there is that bit about it, but there's a kind of honesty throughout which makes you really on its side. I think it's pretty much autobiographical, but Etienne's life. It's about a young guy who leaves the kind of safeness of a middle class upbringing where he's been adopted, and then comes down, a young black man, and then comes down to Glasgow because he wants to take risks. He wants to do different things. He's interested in music and all of these things, but it brings him into conflict and it brings him danger that wouldn't have happened at home, you know. And you see that later on when he kind of goes back. He has to go back home for various reasons. When he's in the big city, he clashes with police, he clashes with other people. Again, it's that thing about belonging. Where do I belong? How do I fit in? Do I, in fact, belong? And sometimes you get the kindness of others, but you also get the opposite side of that as well. And it's actually available to watch on STV Player at the moment. It just came on in the last couple of weeks. And it is well worth watching. I find it incredible that this guy has basically just said, no, I'm going to find a way to do this. And he's managing to get it done. So I'd love to see what happens next. But this is a great kind of calling card. I would say the comic book was a calling card. And he did say, I'd love to make Beats of War into a film. Now, that's obviously a different level altogether when you're talking superheroes. But for him to take this autobiographical story and get it made and get a good set of actors, we spoke to not just Etienne, but some of the cast on the podcast as well. I think it's almost miraculous because I'm guessing, you know, I don't know the budget, but I'm pretty sure, you know, you're talking about, in comparison to most things, absolutely minuscule. And that's called The Difference Between Us. And it's a really interesting film. It's well worth you taking your time to watch it. Back on track with your next choice, Chris.
Well, it actually follows on quite nicely from what you were saying. I promise we haven't plotted all this out, but it really segues quite nicely into what I was wanting to talk about, which is, I think, when I was talking earlier about it feeling like quite slim pickings for a long stretch of this year, I think part of the problem is for me that there haven't been that many particularly exciting new and emerging filmmakers over the last few years, particularly post-pandemic. And I think a big problem with that does come down to funding issues, like you were saying there, Ali. If you want to see somebody who actually has an interesting, new and authentic voice, it kind of feels like they have to self-fund almost to an extent, or work with these prohibitively low budgets because the money just isn't there. And I see it even firsthand at work, where so people have to jump through so many hoops to get something made and tick so many seemingly arbitrary boxes that by the time it actually makes it to screen, it can feel like it's really sanded down. You know, even when it's something with the best intentions, even when it's, obviously in the wake of the past few years, obviously a rightfully increased attention paid to, what gets broadly labeled diversity on screen. But when you think about the positions of power are still being held by largely white middle class, well-off cis straight people, a lot of the time the the efforts ended up, you know, they feel like they need to pander to an audience who look like the people in those positions of power. So any of the kind of the rough edges and the interesting aspects ended up get sanded down. I think it can be really frustrating for people who want to tell these stories and get them out there that they still are bound by these kind of power structures, which makes it all the more incredible when a film actually does break through from a first-time director who is able to address, you know, these audiences who maybe aren't catered to in film so often and really break through. And for me, that was the case this year with Alice Diop's debut film, Saint-Omer, which is another French film. But it's another one like May December that is based on a very upsetting true story, but is kind of fictionalized. You know, it's very, like, the details of the case are there if you want them, but, you know, names have been changed and liberties have been taken, so it's not quite as you know, as salacious as all that. But it's based on a true story of a Senegalese woman in France who's accused of murdering her child by leaving the child on a beach to be swept out by the tide. And it's a kind of courtroom drama where a woman, a kind of a lecturer, an artist in her own right, who is largely a substitute figure for Alice Diop herself. She's another woman born to a Senegalese immigrant mother. She hears this story about another Senegalese immigrant and what's happening. Something just kind of resonates with her. She herself is pregnant at the time, and she decides to kind of go and sit in on the trial, and it brings up all these lingering issues of, you know, like ambivalence about motherhood and relationship to her own Senegalese identity and France's legacy of colonialism. But it doesn't do it in a heavy-handed way, and it doesn't do it in a totally didactic way or anything. It doesn't feel like you're being force-fed, you know, these issues. It is first and foremost a really riveting kind of courtroom drama, dealing with, you know, aspects of life in France that probably aren't brought to the surface as forcefully as this. But at the same time, it's not done in that way where, you know, as I say, the edges are sanded off. You know, the characters are allowed to be flawed. They're allowed to have ugly sides. They're allowed to engage in other high art. You know, we see like our protagonist, like, lecturing about Marguerite Duras, and like she watches Pasolini films, and the structure of the story is obviously kind of evokes Medea, and that's brought up directly as well. So it has all these kind of aspects that generally, you know, when you're talking about like on-screen diversity, it's generally not considered by the people who are paying for stuff like this. It's just a really intelligently made film that's in conversation with a lot of sources that aren't usually considered, again, when telling stories like this. It's not quite like social realism. It's not quite, you know, your straightforward courtroom drama. But it's just a really strikingly intelligent way of dealing with a very upsetting subject in a form, you know, everybody is kind of familiar with, but it is still finding new ways to kind of to process that and deal with it. It's really, really strongly recommend it.
Just remind us what it's called again,
Chris. Saint-Omer, which is the town that the trial takes place in. So nobody is being canonized in the course of the film. Spelled like Saint, so Saint-Omer. So Saint-Omer. By Alice Diop.
Wesley, your next choice.
I think following on from the theme that has been brought up in the past couple picks, or at least from what Chris was talking about there in terms of emerging filmmakers, there was a film this year by Molly Manning Walker, who, again, I believe this is her first film, so another absolutely storming debut in my mind, I believe, called How to Have Sex, which the premise of it is, you know, fairly simple, but fairly traumatic, I'd imagine, for certain people who watch this film. Basically, a group of British teenage girls go on a sort of, you know, teenage holiday, going clubbing, drinking, etc. They go to Malia and go there to, you know, have this incredible summer holiday that they've always wanted to have together. And parts of it they do have that, but there is elements of it that are quite traumatic for the people involved, particularly the lead character, and it covers topics of coercion, of consent, and it is, it's a really great film, it really is, and just watching it, I just thought it must be complete nightmare fuel for, I mean, I just can't imagine how painful it must be for certain women and teenage girls to watch certain parts of this film. But at the same time, there is lots of elements of it that focus on how deep friendship runs and how important that can be, which is great. I think that there's not a lot of insight, obviously, I can offer from the trio of girls that lead the film's perspective, believe it or not. But I think it still is a really important film that a lot of men should watch as well, because it really just focuses on that impact of what you could say is basically social conditioning about how we have a tendency as a society to be silently complicit in the way that we speak to the younger generation about sex and about consent. And it really leaves the sort of door ajar for conversations about that to happen at different age groups, and how we sort of approach the idea of sex, what we learn about it, what our expectations are of it, and how that sort of complicates and intertwines with our notions of self-identity, specifically as a teenager. And it's so much to say, I think, underneath the surface of, you know, like teenage holiday in Malia, like kind of Brits abroad type thing, which it could really fall into the trap of being, and it genuinely isn't. And I think that's because the cast at the heart of it all are just, they're really phenomenal, honestly. The performances are so raw, and that it feels almost like you're watching like a kind of documentary. Like sometimes, like it's sort of cinema verite at times, how real it feels when you watch it. And I think that's also because you know these characters. Like, if you haven't been these characters, you can see parts of yourselves in them. Yeah. And that's what's really interesting about it. And that's whether that's, you know, for better or for worse, and all those sort of elements that come together. And the lead character is played by someone called Mia McKenna Bruce, who I don't really know too much about beyond this film. But the way that she can deal with the complex emotions of her character on screen is really remarkable. And honestly, like, I can't wait to see what she stars in next, because she's supported by an amazing cast, but she really leads the way in it, and it's great. And as I said about that Brits Abroad element, like, I feel like it could easily just like lead into that sort of litany of caricatures of how these people sort of act abroad, but it pulls it all back into focusing on those little beautiful elements of the kindness of kind of strangers and how deep friendships run, and that kind of ride or die feeling you've got when you're a teenager, specifically for teenage girls as well, obviously. This reckless abandon that you have, and obviously the absolute dire consequences of a horrible misogynistic society that is inflicted upon everyone, including, you know, the effects that has on men too, in terms of how complicit they are in a lot of this stuff just by not saying anything, even if they feel like it's happening in front of them and they're not actually active and stopping these things from happening. And yeah, the conversations it sort of brings to the fore are great. And yeah, young British filmmaker, I think, as I said, debut film. Excited to see what they do next.
Yeah,
it was great, really just cutting edge, just really raw, really authentic. Yeah, brilliant.
Go back to that thing that we've all talked about previously, is seeing these things done honestly on screen, whereas before it was maybe not so honest, or at least aspects of it weren't acknowledged.
Absolutely. Yep. It's facing the uncomfortability, isn't it? It's and it goes back to, you know, the May December thing. I mean, they're completely different films, but it's that, you know, mirror held back up at you, at society, at the people who are watching it. It doesn't have to have a sort of conclusion in the sense of here is a really strong directive and message from it, but starting the conversation is enough, and that is enough to keep the conversation going. And I think that's what's really exciting me about a lot of recent filmmaking, is back into that level of ambiguity again. Not ambiguity, that's not the right word, because obviously none of this is ambiguous. Yeah. We all know where to stand on it, but in terms of starting those conversations and getting people to talk about it is really effective.
Fantastic. So my next film is probably my favourite of the year I saw this year, which is My Name is Alfred Hitchcock by Mark Cousins. So it's a really fascinating, Mark Cousins has written and directed it, but Alistair McGowan is Hitchcock as the narrator through the whole thing. And he does it, it's brilliantly done. So what Cousins has done is basically put his ideas in, literally into the mouth of Hitchcock and almost represent them as Hitchcock's own. So he's, oh, this is what I meant by this, and this is what I meant by this. But of course it's Mark Cousins' idea. So on it, and there's some nice little touches where Hitchcock asks a question, is that right? And you'll hear Mark Cousins' equally distinctive voice going, yes, that's correct, or yes, go on, or I like that, or that kind of thing, which kind of throws you out of the film a little bit. It's made up of just lots of footage of Alfred Hitchcock movies, most of which I knew, but a lot I didn't know, you know, because he was so prolific, particularly in the early days when he was just really churning out a lot of stuff. Not churning out, that's the wrong word. Making a lot of stuff, but you know, he was under contracts and things like that. And it's split into kind of six parts, or at least Mark Cousins' thesis is that you can split it, the films, into six parts in terms of themes, which are escape, desire, loneliness, time, fulfillment, and height. And I have to say that the last one kind of feels a little bit forced, but I get what he's getting at, is that a lot of the great thing is he knows the film so well, or he's done his research so well, and I'm guessing he knew them already. He's got every example to back up his claims that you could possibly have, you know? So he's got all the, I mean, it's quite a long film. It's not like a, you know, a short thing. I can't think off the top of my head how long, but it's a thorough examination of Alfred Hitchcock, the movies. And I was thinking Mark Cousins as a filmmaker who's kind of slightly obsessed with looking anyway. You know, it's the look of the film, not the look of the film, but looking at the film and what's going on. He's not one for plot either, I would say, necessarily, Chris. You know, it's about how the film's made and the themes behind the film and what's not being said rather than what's being said. And in that way, it's the perfect subject matter for him. And it's kind of like a love letter to Alfred Hitchcock, the director, as well as Alfred Hitchcock's movies too. I'm a big Hitchcock fan. I don't think you have to be to love it. Maybe you do. But if you're a fan of film anyway, you know, there's something in there for you. But I'm guessing the Venn diagram of Hitchcock and film fans, there's a big intersection, I would imagine, there anyway. I've watched this a couple of times because it's one of those films where you'll miss it. You can't just kind of let it wash over you. You really have to pay attention. And I think that's the thing with all Mark Cousins films, is you really do have to pay attention. And you probably should with Alfred Hitchcock as well, because there'll be things that you miss. There's lots of lovely little touches where he says, no, I told you I was going to lie once to you, and here's what that lie is. And it, you know, goes into all these things, and it talks about the MacGuffins and everything that you wanted to know about Hitchcock. And it goes into his private life and all his kind of, it doesn't go in too strong on his many odd obsessions and peccadillos, but they are mentioned and they are kind of included there. I really like Mark Cousins as a filmmaker. He might not be for everyone, but I really think he's one of the best around. And for him to do something like this on Hitchcock, it was like, oh, wow, someone's, you know, it's like ticking boxes for me all over the place.
I'm a big fan of Mark Cousins, so that sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. You can get it on Prime Video, I think, but, you know, you might have to pay for it. But I saw it in the cinema, which was great again, because you saw all the kind of big Hitchcock moments on the big screen. Chris, final mention for you.
I'm going to be very cheeky and chuck a handful in here under a broad umbrella. Right. So on the opposite end of the spectrum from the kind of new filmmakers kind of struggling to break through, maybe due to funding and stuff, I think another kind of concomitant problem with that is, like, I think there's a lot of filmmakers working now who you'd like generalize as being like masters, you know, the kind of the older statesmen or whatever, who are still making really great work year after year, who people maybe take for granted a little bit now. It's like, oh, cool, like another really good Steven Spielberg film or whatever, you know, because he makes it look so easy. So, like, I feel like, yeah, Spielberg's The Fablemans at the start of the year, his kind of cinematic autobiography kind of came and went without making a lot of mark. It was one of his best films in a long time. Working again with Tony Kushner, who he worked with on West Side Story a couple of years ago, but also like Lincoln and Munich before that. Tony Kushner, obviously, like incredible playwright, who wrote Angels in America. So it's kind of applying that kind of like very keen eye to Spielberg's own life, and it becomes this kind of skeleton key for unlocking the much maybe the way that the Cousins Hitchcock documentary is for Hitchcock. There's so many things that you're like, oh well, I guess that explains why all of Spielberg's films have this in them or that in them or that, the, like even down to this tiny specific detail is like a bit where, you know, it's roughly the story of his parents' divorce. And it even comes down to minute details like his mom at one point bringing home a pet monkey who the family all hate, and then you're like, oh yeah, a monkey betrayed Indiana Jones, right? You know, just like tiny stuff like this where you're like, how can you that be from your own autobiography, like this this fantastical detail of like a monkey who gives Nazi salutes and like, you know, like and like betrays our heroes. It's like, how could that have seeds in something that actually happened to you? But yeah, so like Spielberg, I thought that happened this year. I thought it happened to David Fincher as well this year, who came back very strong with The Killer, his kind of graphic novel adaptation hitman movie. I mean, I think Fincher is unparalleled among filmmakers currently working in the kind of loosely in the kind of thriller crime genre. It's when he tries to stray outside of that he maybe stumbles a little bit with, you know, like Mank or Benjamin Button, or, you know, I think the only example I can think of where he's really fully dodged that is The Social Network. But like when like there's nobody who can touch him as like a, in terms of like a genre workout, you know. I think The Killer was very misunderstood in a lot of quarters. I think it's a lot funnier than people give it credit for, like deliberately funny. Like I said this to a friend last week, and he asked me like, what did you, in like a so bad it's good way, did you think it was bad? I was like, no, I think it's really genuinely funny. It's a story of a hitman who has like a work playlist set up that he listens to while he's doing hits, and it's all the Smiths. Like there's over a dozen Smiths needle drops in this film, and like I laughed harder every time one appeared. But it also feels like a kind of spiritual sequel to Fight Club. You know, it's been updated from this era of like IKEA and, you know, single serving friends and all this kind of stuff, all the kind of buzzwords from the late 90s. And now, like in the open scenes, Fassbender as a hitman is operating out of a WeWork office in Paris. He's in Paris eating McDonald's, you know, like it's just all these kind of like consumerism aspects of consumer society are kind of interwoven with this kind of hitman story in a way that is like, I think there's more substance to it than a lot of people, as I say, are giving it credit for. Wes Anderson's Asteroid City, another like real, I mean, you can't even call it a return to form because I think he's just very consistently good. But his best film since Grand Budapest Hotel, I think, another one about the kind of the unknowability of a lot of the world and how you just kind of have to keep going. And then it weaves this story of like a UFO visitation to a small desert town and nuclear in the shadow of nuclear testing with, you know, method acting and like an actor's craft and why we tell stories and, you know, all this. There's just so much going on with it, so much life to it. And again, one that people are just like, oh, another Wes Anderson movie, you know, oh, he's doing his Dollhouse thing again. It's like, well, yeah, it's his style, but he's perfected it and nobody else does it that way, and nobody else is capable of using that style so effectively to, you know, tell these stories that conceal these depths of emotion and hurt and grief and you know, these very basic human conditions. You know, he does it in this very recognizable way. But again, I think that's because there's so few directors working in anything close to the mainstream who have so recognizable a style, you know. And he is continuing to find new wrinkles on it and find new ways to express himself within that kind of recognizable aesthetic. Oh, do I have time for? Oh, yeah, I've got to fit in one more. Right, one more. Killers of the Flower Moon, Scorsese's latest as well, which again, like, is kind of a new thing for Scorsese in that. It's effectively his long promised Western, you know. It's and but it does play about with familiar themes in terms of, you know, it's the kind of the seedier side of American history. It fits in with his style over the past decade, where he's kind of becoming more austere. You know, there's less of the flashy cuts and the sense of like vicarious enjoyment. You know, he's really kind of making you like suffer through it with the characters. You know, it's the story of an oil find on Osage territory, the kind of indigenous people in Osage territory suddenly becoming per capita the richest people in America, and the money and the profit gradually being leached off them by the white populace around them, who also engage in a campaign of basically killing them off. And the heart of the film is the kind of toxic marriage between Leonardo DiCaprio's Ernest Burkhart, who is white, and Lily Gladstone's Molly, who his wife, who is indigenous, who is Osage. And it's literally a toxic relationship. You know, he is literally slowly poisoning her with a view to eventually inheriting her money, you know, kind of like suspicion, you know, like, again, to bring it back to Hitchcock, is this question of like, you know, does she know that he's doing this? Is she? Because we are in on it from the start. You know, there's no mystery. There's no sense. Is you're really there with him as he does this, and you've got to try and sit with how can this guy, like, simultaneously clearly love his wife, but also be so committed to the idea of taking her money that he's willing to put her through this. You know, and again, it's a long haul. It's about 3 hours 20 minutes, so it's maybe one that's maybe going to be more difficult to sit through at home, but it rewards the attention. And there's a real kind of incredible capper to like the very final scene. It kind of takes it to another, well, I don't want to spoil it, but it reframes it in a way that I think you would be very hard pressed to see coming, even from sitting through the previous 3 hours 10 minutes. And it's that, when you, as we're talking about your scene of the year in past lives, I think the very end of Killers of the Flower Moon is maybe my scene of the year. It's just, yeah, it's incredible.
That's amazing.
That's when the aliens attack.
Yeah, that's when the aliens. Yeah. So it's when the aliens from Asteroid City get attacked. They've killed everyone in Asteroid City, and they come to resolve the situation.
But I think that, yes, that's a really interesting question. All four of those directors, as you said, who've been around with us for a long time, who definitely have a style. Even if people, I think it's almost what people think, I know what they do, when actually they do different things each time. But there's a kind of framework.
And do. I mean, it is a historic, like, historically, like, directors have styles, you know. You're did Hitchcock go through this? Did Howard Hawks and John Ford go through this? You know, every time they put out more variations on their pet themes, you know, it feels like people have kind of maybe come to expect, or I don't know, maybe they just, I don't know what people want from certain days. Like, you know, when you go back to like a favorite author who has pet themes or whatever, you know, it feels like a similar thing here. But I don't think any of them are repeating themselves. I think they're all finding new wrinkles and new variations on the things they like to talk about and the styles they like to work in. But I don't think any of them are just retreading past glories with the films that they've put out this year.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's interesting. I mean, maybe have time to talk briefly about this at the end. It might be partly to do with how much stuff's going out there and how we consume it. You know, like how, you know, not maybe going to the cinema as a big thing to see these big tentpole directors, but you know it's going to be on your phone within months or whatever it might be. Anyway, Wes, what about your fifth choice?
Honestly, like Chris, I swear we have not rehearsed this, but speaking about going to the cinema to see the big tentpole releases and everything else, event cinema, I have the honour of finishing all these picks off by picking Barbie. I cannot not talk about this film.
Yep.
Obviously, we all know about the whole Barbenheimer marketing campaign that sort of re-energized getting people back through the doors of cinema, at least in terms of a blockbuster sense, of course. So I'm not going to really talk too much on that, but it was, you know, a really monumental moment this year, I think, in cinema. Excuse me. Not necessarily for the films that we tend to talk about on this podcast, but it genuinely felt like an authentic moment of people actually going out to the cinema for an experience that they were enjoying, something that we've not really had for a long time, other than people turning up to see, you know, the latest Marvel or Star Wars release, which, you know, we have discussed at length in this podcast. But it just felt something new and fresh, and it was great. The film itself is what a film it was. It really was. I don't know if either of you have seen it.
No, I haven't, no.
But
I didn't. I saw Oppenheimer instead.
Yeah, I mean, I did see both. I didn't do them both in the same day, but we did them a week apart. But we loved Barbie. I thought it was great. It was it's great. It's just what these big sort of event pieces of cinema, I think, should be, in my mind, at least, anyway. I mean, there's homages in it to Powell and Pressburger. I mean, there's all these sort of old Gene Kelly movie musical magic that's in it. Bob Fosse, all that jazz. You can see all of this stuff throughout it. There's some stunning painted backdrops throughout this film as well, which really, I think Greta Gerwig said she really tried to play with that sort of authentic element versus the sort of artificiality of everything that is that central premise of Barbie, of course. And just so much love and care and attention just went into every element of this film. It was great. And yes, many people have been really sniffy about how it's not feminist enough and it's not anti-capitalist enough. But without really, you know, getting into that too much detail, I just don't know what they were expecting from that. I mean, film is firmly capitalist. It is. Of course it is. That is completely obvious. It can't be anything other than completely capitalist. So I don't know how you go about dismantling the patriarchy while being capitalist or without being anti-capitalist, you know, but that's fine because I can still enjoy the film for what it is. I think when you approach the film with that in mind, then it does make some of the more understandable criticisms of it and the shortcomings, you know, that it inevitably does have a bit easier to swallow and easier to enjoy the film as a whole. So I think it was always going to be a corporate cash grab. Of course it was. And the film was going to be made one way or another, no matter if Greta Gerwig was at the helm of it or not. So I'm just really glad that it did fall into the hands of Greta Gerwig because she is such a great filmmaker. So at least we could properly enjoy it. She pushed it as far as I think somebody possibly could within the confines of that corporate decision-making element, if you like. And it must have been, I mean, I say it must have been really difficult to balance this. I mean, I'm sure it was so difficult when, you know, she made all the money off of it. But great, good for her. She deserves it. She's put out some amazing stuff over the years. But it would have been difficult to balance what is essentially a rebranding exercise for Mattel and the actual film that Greta Gerwig probably wanted to make. But what she does do is really handles it so well with this deft touch, just so much humour in it. As I say, the production and the design of it, the heart of it. Yes, it's a little bit feminism 101, and I can see how people kind of don't like that, but it really appeals to, I think, the inner child, which is why it's kind of landed so well. And just that idea of like nostalgia and memories and personal meaning to the people that kind of watch the film. So while it's not breaking any new ground in terms of, you know, intersectionality or radical feminism, it is sort of stripping back the fundamentals of what that is, of what equality is, and sort of packaging it into something that is palatable, relatable, and completely over the top fun, obviously within that corporate setting, which is slightly contradictory, but it's great. It's just a total blast from start to finish, and it's a return to that bubblegum, big budget, colourful, playful blockbusters that I've missed for so long, as opposed to the sort of drab, self-serious, kind of colourless franchises that we've seen on cinema quite a lot. And I'm just so happy it exists, even if it is within that corporate shell. Doesn't always work, as I've said. It does occasionally struggle to balance its ambitions a little bit with its corporate KPIs, so to speak. And I could spend a long time picking apart like different elements of it that do kind of up me a little bit. You know, it's a bit liberal feminism, feminist, like centrist politics, and sort of all these kind of corporate capitalist agendas that are very like, oh, that's quite funny, isn't it, that we're poking fun at that, but obviously you know that Mattel are behind it. But as I said, that's all at the expense of what is so good about it and what is so fun about it, and it's holding it up to unrealistic expectations, I think. So I think it's the best thing you could realistically hope for from a Barbie movie, and it's so funny. It's great.
It would never have got made without Mattel, so if you take that on, talking to Mattel, it's a long way since Dolph Lundgren played He-Man in the Masters of the Universe movie.
Absolutely.
There's another attempt at that. You couldn't get further away.
Honestly, I mean, I think there's some human elements in it that I do wish it had lingered on a little bit and took a different direction. There's a beautiful scene where Barbie meets this older woman on a park bench, and I won't really spoil the details of it, but there's just this really, again, talking about like scenes of kind of quietness, where there's just this quiet moment between the two of them, and it's beautiful. And then it just goes into a completely madcap direction, which I really enjoyed, but I wish it explored a little bit more of that. But I don't think I can say anything too negative about it other than it worked for me. The only thing I could really say, if there's a negative takeaway, and it's not really its fault, but is that rather than sort of, I'm talking about how nostalgic bubblegum cinema can be really appealing when it's got that emotional connection and resonance with a large portion of the population, that's how it works well. But Hollywood is obviously going to see it as the perfect excuse to trot out, you know, an original soulless corporate IP and package it all up as being this subversive, quirky type of stuff. And we're already seeing it. I mean, I think they're talking about making a Hot Wheels film. like an Uno film, a Barney film. I mean, like, it's ridiculous and it's not going to be that great, but I feel like that's a consequence of everything that is the kind of good elements of stuff that then inevitably becomes, well, that worked.
Yeah.
Let's recreate it again.
I think that was part of my reluctance to see it, is like, much as I really like Greta Gerwig's past work, was the knowledge that I would ultimately be paying for what the studio would see as a toy advert, you know?
Absolutely.
And it would be like, and you knew, like, looking at Barbenheimer weekend, that, like, no matter what the success of both of those films, that, like, studios are just going to take the wrong lessons from both of them. And so with Barbie, it's going to be, we need more IP. With Oppenheimer, it's going to be, like, we need more dull historical biopics. And it's nothing to do with the fact that the individual people who, like, made the film, or, you know, like, the vision that they had for it or anything like this, you know, like... I'm not a huge Christopher Nolan fan. I do think Oppenheimer is one of his better films, but any success that Oppenheimer has is down to it being made by Nolan, you know, like, people, and that's what people respond to. It's not just purely the fact that it's a historical biopic. And similarly with Barbie, the respondent, what Greta Gerwig brought to it. I thought it was really funny, just again talking about his commercial success, Variety do these, like, directors on directors interviews where, like, you know, directors interview one another, and they paired Greta Gerwig with James Cameron, and I was like, one weird pairing, but then realized that, like, they are the two writer directors responsible for the highest grossing films of all time that aren't franchises, that aren't, you know, sequels. I mean, Barbie is obviously debatable because it's based on a toy, it's based on obviously pre-existing intellectual property, but, like, yeah, like, Cameron with, like, Avatar and Titanic, and Greta Gerwig with Barbie, they're the highest grossing films of all time that aren't sequels, prequels in a pre-established series, you know, based on comic books or whatever it is. It's wild. It's wild that Gerwig, like, who a decade ago was just breaking out with, like, roles in, like, Noah Baumbach films, and before that came from, like, Mumblecore, is now, like, one of the most financially successful filmmakers in the world. It's absolutely wild.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my final choice is another documentary, and I only watched this recently. It's called Loch Ness, They Created a Monster, directed by John McClaverty, made by Hopscotch, who did Dog Days that I mentioned earlier on as well. And it's based on footage from the 1970s and 80s, the big hunt for Nessie. And I knew, I kind of remembered that a little bit, but how big this was and how obsessed people were. You know, people in America leaving good jobs and family lives and coming over to Loch Ness to hunt for Nessie. And a lot of kind of hippies, you know, deciding that's where we want to go. It's interesting, a lot of the footage is shot in the summer. So it does look idyllic, you know, as Loch Ness and the whole area does when it's, you know, sunny. It was so huge. You had footage of David Attenborough on Parkey, and they were discussing, and he says, oh no, I think, you know, these people wouldn't lie, and there's something out there, whatever it might be. You later get the caveat in the same interview, he said, well, you know, the proof's still to come out and all that. And this has got everything but the proof. That's what's so interesting about it. It's got belief. It's got that desire to think about the... It made me question what it is. And it's still there, I think, that people have this desire that something that is unknown, I'm just going to believe it exists. And a lot of the time through the documentary, they return to that fact is, Nessie exists if you believe it. You know, so you're talking about that kind of idea of faith in this creature. And, you know, people made livings. The area did very well out of it. But there's also been things like there were groupies going up to, you know, fall at the feet of these middle-aged men, often in caravans, really odd. And there was death threats. There was even suspicion of murder. There was sabotage, subterfuge, submarines, obviously. But again, very little concrete proof. There was a Japanese team that went, who were headed by a Chinese entrepreneur. This was the guy who got Muhammad Ali over to Japan to fight a sumo wrestler. And they were, this was a kind of, you know, and he got Tom Jones into China. And so that was his background. He was a kind of, you know, odd figure. And of course, it was a complete spoof. It was their version of, you know, foreigners do the funniest things. And, you know, he was being interviewed on telly and he was saying, I would love to catch Nessie, and I will give it to Her Highness, and I will kill it if she wants me to kill it. And it's just all kind of bonkers. And the interviewer's going, what did you mean by Her Highness? And you go, well, you know, the Queen. And it's really bonkers, but it's really it's goofy as well, because it's Scotland at a time where Inverness was still not that easy to get to. You know, there wasn't big motorways and stuff like that, but yet people were making this huge trip to look for this creature that still to this day, the proof is, you know, dodgy to, at the very, and they didn't break it down too much, but then suddenly in the 80s, it wasn't just these people who were taking pictures and all this kind of stuff. The scientists arrived with huge funding, massive funding to look for these creatures, plural, that were perhaps in Loch Ness. It's on iPlayer as well at the moment, so it's a good watch. But again, it's more about the time than the actual subject, because, you know, the subject, we still have no real proof, no matter what you think either way. Yeah, it's almost like, well, we've been to the moon, we have gone to the depth of the sea, what's next? Well, is there a dinosaur in this loch in Scotland? Yeah, it's called Loch Ness. They created a monster, and it's still, I mean, I go up there quite a bit, and, you know, they're still making money out of Nessie to this very day. But it's full of really interesting characters as well, kind of real eccentric types who rub each other up the wrong way too. You know, guns are pulled and things like that. It's really, it's the kind of Wild West of, I mean, you wouldn't call it archaeology, would you? Whatever it is, fantasy. The Wild West of fantasy up in the Highlands.
I love the sound of this. It's great. As always,
it's really good. Great
to dig out an iPlayer, Ali. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's our five picks each.
Five.
Well, whoa, whoa. Five. Yes, I'll remember that for next time, Chris. Yeah. Five. I think it'd be quite nice, briefly, before we finish up, to maybe talk about one thing that you're looking forward to coming up next year, Chris.
Oh, not even next year. Like, you're talking like next week over here, I guess. But I'm champing at the bit to see Ferrari, the new Michael Mann film. Michael Mann, one of my favorite. I already mentioned Miami Vice earlier in the podcast. One of my favorite working filmmakers, but he hasn't really been for over the last decade. This is his first film in 9 years. He hasn't made a film since Black Hat. Came out in early 2015. I'm not seeing it because I'm particularly excited about Ferrari as a person. Or like the concept of seeing like the cars in action or anything like this. I'm excited for Mann to be doing stuff again. He'd done a couple of bits and pieces here and there. He directed the pilot for Tokyo Vice. He wrote a sequel to Heat, which he published as a novel, and which I believe he's now looking to adapt into a film. But yeah, this is his first substantial piece of work in nearly a decade. So that's top of the priority list for me over the coming weeks.
Excellent. Yeah, you don't strike me as the kind of person that had a Ferrari poster on.
Nah, not like, you know, like, I know, like, there was the, what was the one, was it Ford v Ferrari that came out a couple of years ago that had, yeah, like Matt Damon and Christian Bale in it? Like, yeah, I wasn't queuing up to see that. Like, I'm my interest in this, like, starts and ends with it being a Michael Mann film. So that's, yeah, that's the main priority. But yeah, it's going to be a really busy few weeks. Like, as I was saying, there's loads of stuff coming out. You know, there's a new Alexander Payne, there's new Sofia Coppola, there's so much coming out over the next couple of weeks. So yeah, we'll probably end up talking about a lot of them this time next year.
Make a note to talk about it, and we can talk about it next year. Wesley, what about yourself? Is there something that you're particular, or maybe even you've just seen that the rest of us haven't?
Well, do you know, strangely, that when you mentioned that, I was like very rudely panic searching 2024 UK releases on my phone there, because I was like, what is actually coming out? Usually there's always something that I think we end the this film podcast with, me being like, or Chris being like, next year is going to be, this is going to be my top film of the year. I know it already. I can feel it in my bones. I can't actually think of that much. I mean, Priscilla is coming out in January, which I had the privilege of seeing at the London Film Festival this year, which, I mean, I loved it, spoiler alert. a big Sofia Coppola fan, and I think it was a really interesting film. There's a few other things coming out, but I think probably the one that I'm looking forward to the most really is The Boy and the Heron, which is the new Studio Ghibli. Yeah. I mean, I've been watching Studio Ghibli films for, since I was young, and I still don't know how to pronounce to pronounce it properly. But yeah, it's the new one from Hayao Miyazaki, who famously is on a retirement cycle every 5 years, and has now brought another one out on his 80s. So you would expect it's probably his last film, but from what we know of Hayao Miyazaki, probably is not going to be his last film. Would not be surprised if he knocks another one out in his 90s. But yeah, I think that's getting a Boxing Day release here, maybe, which should be lovely. So I'm going to hopefully treat myself to a little GFT trip, because I haven't obviously don't get to go to GFT a lot these days to see the to see that between Christmas and New Year. So that's what I'm most looking forward to. Yeah, and that's literally what within the next week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know you've already seen this, Wesley. I'm really looking forward to seeing Poor Things, the adaptation of Alistair Gray. I'm sure we'll talk about that next year, because I'm going to count it. Since I haven't seen it, Chris hasn't seen it, we'll talk about
Definitely.
it next year. And then you can talk freely, Wes, without wondering about, you know, absolutely. The other thing I'd like to mention is they're doing an adaptation of Amy Liptrot's novel, The Outrun.
Oh, yeah, of course, with
Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's set in Orkney. And yeah, it's going to be at Sundance this year, so I'll be interested to see the feedback from that. But that's looking to be quite special, I think.
That's a great shout, yeah.
Well, guys, we've made it through another year. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It's always a pleasure to catch up.
Oh, likewise. Yeah. Highlight of the year, as always.
And we'll be back soon with different people, probably in a new year. Take care and have a great one. Cheers.